he added, shifting Oggy into a new position. I know where the wine is. Chapter 5 Meditations on a Hyoid.
It all begins in medias res, and if you're lucky, it ends that way as well.
Roger swallowed, and I felt his larynx bob under my fingers. The skin of his throat was cool and smooth where I held it, though I could feel a tiny prickle of beard stubble brush my knuckle just under his jaw.
That's what Dr. McEwen said? I asked curiously. What did he mean by it, I wonder?
Roger's eyes were closed. People normally close their eyes when I examined them, as though needing to preserve what privacy they could. But at this, he opened them, an arresting deep green lit by the morning sun.
I asked him. He said that nothing ever truly starts or stops, so far as he could see. That people think a child's life begins at birth, but plainly that's not so. You can see them move in the womb, and a child that comes too soon will often live for a short time, and you see that it's alive in all its senses, even though it can't sustain life.
Now I'd closed my own eyes, not because I found Roger's gaze unsettling, but in order to concentrate on the vibrations of his words. I moved my grip on his throat a little lower.
Well, he's quite right about that, I said, envisioning the inner anatomy of the throat as I talked. Babies are born already running, as it were. All their processes, except breathing, are working long before birth. But that's still a rather cryptic remark.
Yes, it was.
He swallowed again, and I felt his breath warm on my bare forearm.
I prodded him a bit, because he'd obviously meant it by way of explanation, or at least the best he could do by way of explanation. I don't suppose you could describe what it is you actually do when you heal someone, could you?
I smiled at that without opening my eyes.
Oh, I might have a go at it, but there's an implied error there. I don't actually heal people. They heal by themselves. I just support them.
A sound that wasn't quite a laugh made his larynx execute a complicated double bob. I thought I could feel a slight concavity under my thumb, where the cartilage had been partially crushed by the rope. I put my other hand round my own throat for comparison.
That's actually what he said, too. Hector McEwen, I mean. But he did heal people. I saw him do it.
My hands released both our throats, and I opened my eyes. He gave me a quick précis of his relations with William Buckley, from Buck's role in his hanging at Almance, through the reappearance of his ancestor in Inverness in 1980, and Buck's joining him in the search for Jem after Brianna's erstwhile co-worker Rob Cameron had kidnapped the boy.
That was when he became a bit more than a friend, Roger said.
He looked down and cleared his throat.
He came with me to search for Jem. Jem wasn't there, of course, but we did find another Jeremiah. My father, he said abruptly, his voice cracking on the word.
I reached by reflex for his hand, but he waved me off, clearing his throat again.
It's okay. I'll tell you about that later.
He swallowed and straightened a little, meeting my eyes again.
But Buck, that's what we called him, Buck. When we came through the stones in search of Jem, we were both damaged by the passage. You said, I think, that it got worse if you did it more than once.
I wouldn't say once isn't damaging, I said, with a small internal shudder at the memory of that void, a chaos where nothing seems to exist but noise.
That, and the faint flicker of thought, all that holds you together between one breath and the next. But yes, it does get worse. What happened to you?
To me, not that much. Unconscious for a bit. Woke up strangling, fighting for air. Marked sweat. Disorientation. Couldn't keep my balance for a bit. Staggered all over. But Buck...
He frowned, and I saw his eyes change as he looked inward again, seeing the green hilltop of Craig na Doon as he woke with the rain on his face, as I had waked 3 times. The hair on my neck rose slowly.
It seemed to be his heart. He had a pain in his chest, his left arm, and he couldn't breathe well. Said it was like a weight on his chest, and he couldn't get up. I got him water, though, and after a bit he seemed okay. At least he could walk, and he brushed off any suggestion that we stop and rest.
They had separated then, Buck to search the road toward Inverness, Roger to go to Lallybroch, and...
Lallybroch?
This time I did grab him by the arm. You went there?
I did,
he said, and smiled. He clasped my hand where it lay on his arm.
I met Brian Fraser.
You... But Brian?
I shook my head in order to clear it. That made no sense.
No, it didn't make sense,
he said, plainly reading my thoughts from my face and smiling at the results.
We didn't go where... I mean, when we thought we were going. We ended in 1739.
I stared at him for a moment, and he shrugged helplessly. Later, I said firmly, and reached for his throat again, thinking,
in medias res. What the devil did McEwen mean by that?
I could hear distant childish shouts from the direction of the creek, and the high cracked screech of a hawk in the tall snag at the far side of our clearing. I could just see him, or her, from the corner of my eye, a large dark shape like a torpedo on a dead branch. And I was beginning to hear, or to think I heard, the thrum of blood in Roger's neck, a faint sound, separate from the thump of his pulse. And the fact that I was evidently hearing it through my fingertips seemed shockingly ordinary. "Talk to me a bit more," I suggested, as much to avoid hearing what I thought I heard as in order to loosen up his larynx. "About anything?" He hummed for a moment, but that made him cough, and I dropped my hand so he could turn his head.
"Sorry,"
he said.
"Bobby Higgins was just telling me the ridge is growing. A lot of new families are here."
"Like weeds," I said, replacing my hand. "We came back to find that at least 20 new families had settled down, and there's been 3 more just since we came back from Savannah, where the winds of war had briefly blown us." He nodded, a slight frown on his face, and gave me a sidelong green glance.
"I don't suppose any of the new settlers is a minister?"
"No," I said promptly. "Is that what you... I mean, you still think you..."
"I do."
He looked up at me a little shyly.
"I'm not fully ordained yet. I'll need to take care of that somehow. But when we decided to come back, we talked, Bree and I, about what we might do here. And..."
He lifted both shoulders, palms on his knees.
"That's what I might do."
"You were a minister here before," I said, watching his face. "Do you really have to be formally ordained to do it again?"
He didn't have to think. He'd done his thinking long since.
"I do," he said. "I don't feel wrong about having buried or married folk before or christened them. Someone had to do it, and I was all there was. But I want it to be right."
He smiled a little.
"It's maybe like the difference between being handfast and being properly married. Between a promise and a vow. Even if you can, you'd never break the promise. You want..."
He struggled for the words.
"You want the weight of the vow. Something to stand at your back."
A vow. I'd made a few of those. And he was right, all of them. Even those I'd broken had meant something. Had weight. And a few of them had stood at my back. And were still standing. "That does make a difference," I said.
"You know, you were right,"
he said, sounding surprised, and smiled at me.
"It is easy to talk to a doctor, especially one who's got you by the throat." Do you want to give McEwen's method a try, then?
I straighten my back and flex my hands rather self-consciously.
It can't hurt, I said, hoping I was right.
You know, I added hesitantly,
and felt Roger's Adam's apple bob below my hand.
I know, he said gruffly. No expectations. If something happens, well, it does. If not, I'm no worse off.
I nodded and felt gently about, fingertips probing. The tracheotomy I'd performed to save his life had left a smaller scar in the hollow of his throat, a slight depression about an inch long. I passed my thumb over that, feeling the healthy rings of cartilage above and below. The lightness of the touch made him shiver suddenly, tiny goosebumps stippling his neck, and he gave the breath of a laugh.
Goose walking on my grave, he said.
Stamping about on your throat, more like, I said, smiling.
Tell me again what Dr. McEwen said, everything you can remember. I hadn't taken my hand away, and I felt the lurch of his Adam's apple as he cleared his throat hard.
He prodded my throat, much as you're doing, he added, smiling back, and he asked me if I knew what a hyoid bone was. He said...
Roger's hand rose involuntarily toward his throat, but stopped a few inches from touching it.
That mine was an inch or so higher than usual, and that if it had been in the normal place, I'd be dead.
Really? I said, interested.
I put a thumb just under his jaw and said, swallow, please. He did, and I touched my own neck and swallowed, still touching his.
I'll be damned, I said. It's a small sample size, and granted there may be differences attributable to gender, but he may well be right. Perhaps you're a Neanderthal.
What?
He stared at me. Just a joke, I assured him. But it's true that one of the differences between the Neanderthals and modern humans is the hyoid. Most scientists think they hadn't one at all and therefore couldn't speak, but my Uncle Lamb said...
You rather need one for coherent speech, I added, seeing his blank look.
It anchors the tongue. My uncle didn't think they could have been mute, so the hyoid must have been located differently.
How extremely fascinating,
Roger said politely. I cleared my own throat and circled his neck once again.
Right. And after saying about your hyoid, what did McEwen do? How exactly did he touch you?
Roger tilted his head back slightly and, reaching up, adjusted my grip, moving my hand down an inch and gently spreading my fingers.
About like that, he said,
and I found that my hand was now covering, or at least touching, all the major structures of his throat, from larynx to hyoid.
And then?
I was listening intently, not to his voice, but to the sense of his flesh. I'd had my hands on his throat dozens of times, particularly during his recovery from the hanging, but what with one thing and another, I hadn't touched it in several years, until today. I could feel the solid muscles of his neck, firm under the skin, and I felt his pulse, strong and regular. A little fast, and I realized just how important this might be to him. I felt a qualm at that. I had no idea what Hector McEwen might have done, or what Roger might have imagined he'd done, and still less notion how to do anything myself. It's just that I know what a sound larynx should feel like, and I can tell what yours feel like, and I put my fingers there and envision the way it should feel. That's what McEwen had said in response to Roger's questions. I wondered if I knew what a normal larynx felt like.
It was a sensation of warmth.
Roger's eyes had closed again. He was concentrating on my touch. The smooth bulge of his larynx lay under the heel of my hand, bobbing slightly when he swallowed.
Nothing startling. Just the feeling you get when you step into a room where a fire is burning.
Does my touch feel warm to you now?
It should, I thought. His skin was cool.
Yes, he said,
not opening his eyes.
"But it's on the outside. It was on the inside when McEwen did what he did."
His dark brows drew together in concentration. "It...
I felt it. Here."
Reaching up, he moved my thumb to rest just to the right of center, directly below the hyoid.
"And here."
His eyes opened in surprise, and he pressed two fingers to the flesh above his collarbone, an inch or two to the left of the suprasternal notch.
"How odd. I hadn't remembered that."
"And he touched you there as well?" I moved my lower fingers down and felt the quickening of my senses that often happened when I was fully engaged with a patient's body. Roger felt it too. His eyes flashed to mine, startled.
"What?"
he began. But before either of us could speak further, there was a high-pitched yowl from the clearing below. This was instantly followed by a confusion of young voices, more yowling, then a voice immediately identifiable as Mandy in a passion bellowing, "You're bad! You're bad! You're bad and I hate you! You're bad and you're going to hell!" Roger leapt to his feet.
"Amanda!"
he bellowed.
"Come here, right now!"
Over his shoulder, I saw Amanda, face contorted with rage, trying to grab her doll, Esmeralda, which Germain was dangling by one arm just above her head, dancing to keep away from Amanda's concerted attempts to kick him. Startled, Germain looked up, and Amanda connected full force with his shin. She was wearing stout half-boots, and the crack of impact was clearly audible, though instantly superseded by Germain's cry of pain. Jemmy, looking appalled, grabbed Esmeralda, thrust her into Amanda's arms, and with a guilty glance over his shoulder, ran for the woods, followed by a hobbling Germain.
"Jeremiah!" Roger roared. "Stop right there!"
Jem froze, as though hit by a death ray. Germain didn't, and vanished with a wild rustling into the shrubbery. I'd been watching the boys, but a faint choking noise made me glance sharply at Roger. He'd gone pale and was clutching his throat with both hands. I seized his arm. "Are you all right?"
"I don't know."
He spoke in a rasping whisper, but gave me the shadow of a pained smile.
"Think I might have sprained something."
"Daddy," said a small voice beside me. Amanda sniffled dramatically, wiping tears and snot all over her face.
"Is you mad at me, Daddy?"
Roger took an immense breath, coughed, and went over, squatting down to take her in his arms.
"No, sweetheart,"
he said softly, but in a fairly normal voice, and something clenched inside me began to relax.
"I'm not mad. You mustn't tell people they're going to hell, though. Come here. Let's wash your face."
He stood up, holding her, and turned toward my mixing table where there was a basin and ewer. "I'll do it," I said, reaching out for Mandy. "Maybe you want to go and,
talk to Jem?"
"Mm-hmm," he said, and handed her across. A natural snuggler, Mandy at once clung affectionately to my neck and wrapped her legs around my middle.
"Can we wash my dolly's face too?"
she asked.
"Those bad boys got her dirty."
I listened with half an ear to Mandy's mingled endearments to Esmeralda and denunciations of her brother and Germain, but most of my attention was focused on what was going on in the clearing below. I could hear Jem's voice, high and argumentative, and Roger's, firm and much lower, but couldn't pick out any words. Roger was talking, though, and I didn't hear any choking or coughing. That was good. The memory of him bellowing at the children was even better. He'd done that before. It was a necessity, children and the great outdoors being what they respectively were. But I'd never heard him do it without his voice breaking, with a follow-up of coughing and throat clearing. McEwen had said that it was a small improvement, and that it took time for healing. Had I actually done anything to help? I looked critically at the palm of my hand, but it looked much as usual. A half-healed paper cut on the middle finger, stains from picking blackberries, and a burst blister on my thumb from snatching a spider full of bacon that had caught fire out of a hearth without a potholder to shield my hand. Not a sign of any blue light, certainly.
What's that, Granny?
Amanda leaned off the table to look at my upturned hand.
What's what?
That black splotch. I think it's ink. I was writing up my casebook yesterday. Kirsty Wilson's rash. I'd thought at first the rash was just poison sumac, but it was hanging on in a rather worrying fashion. No fever, though. Perhaps it was hives? Or some kind of atypical psoriasis?
No, Dad.
Mandy poked a wet, chubby finger at the heel of my hand.
It's a letter.
She twisted her head halfway round to look closer, black curls tickling across my arm.
Letter J,
she announced triumphantly.
J is for Jemmy. I hate Jemmy,
she added, frowning. I said, completely nonplussed. It was the letter J. The scar had faded to a thin white line, but was still clear if the light struck right. The scar Jamie had given me when I'd left him at Culloden. Left him to die, hurling myself through the stones to save his unborn, unknown child. Our child. And if I hadn't? I looked at Mandy, sherry-eyed and black-curled and perfect as a tiny spring apple. Heard Jem outside, now giggling with his father. It had cost us 20 years apart. Years of heartbreak, pain, and danger. It has been worth it. It's for Grandad's name. J for Jamie, I said to Amanda, who nodded as though that made perfect sense, clutching a soggy Esmeralda to her chest. I touched her glowing cheek and imagined for an instant that my fingers might be tinged with blue, though they weren't. Mandy, I said on impulse, what colour is my hair?
When your hair is white, you'll come into your full power. An old Tuscarora wise woman named Nyawenna had said that to me years ago, along with a lot of other disturbing things.
Mandy stared intently at me for a moment, then said definitely,
Brindle.
What? Where did you learn that word, for heaven's sake?
Uncle Joe. He says that's what colour badger is.
Who's badger?
Auntie Gail's doggy.
I said. Not yet, then. All right, sweetheart. Let's go and hang Esmeralda out to dry. Chapter 6 Home is the Hunter, Home from the Hill. Jamie and Brianna came back in late afternoon with 2 brace of squirrels, 14 doves, and a large piece of stained and tattered canvas that, unwrapped, revealed something that looked like the remnants of a particularly grisly murder. Supper? I asked, gingerly poking at a shattered bone sticking out of the mass of hair and slick flesh. The smell was iron raw and butcherous, with a rank note that seemed familiar, but decay hadn't yet set in to any noticeable degree.
Aye, if you can manage, Sassenach.
Jamie came and peered down at the bloody shambles, frowning a little.
I'll tidy up for you. I need a bit of whisky first, though.
Given the bloodstains on his shirt and breeks, I hadn't noticed the equally stained rag tied around his leg, but now saw that he was limping. Raising a brow, I went to the larger basket of food, small tools and minor medical supplies that I lugged up to the house site every morning.
From what's left of it, I presume that is, or was, a deer. Did you actually tear it apart with your bare hands?
No, but the bear did, Bree said, straight-faced.
She exchanged complicit glances with her father, who hummed in his throat.
Bear, I said, and took a deep breath. I gestured at his shirt. Right. How much of that blood is yours?
Not much,
he said tranquilly, sitting down on the big log.
Whiskey?
I looked sharply at Brianna, but she seemed to be intact. Filthy, and with green-grey bird droppings streaked down her shirt, but intact. Her face glowed with sun and happiness, and I smiled.
There's whiskey in the tin canteen hanging over there, I said, nodding toward the big spruce at the far side of the clearing.
Do you want to fetch it for your father while I see what's left of his leg?
Sure.
Where are Mandy and Jem?
When last seen, they were playing by the creek with Aidan and his brothers.
Don't worry, I added, seeing her lower lip suck suddenly in. It's very shallow there, and Fanny said she'd go and keep an eye on Mandy while she's collecting leeches. Fanny's very dependable.
Mm-hmm.
Bree still looked dubious, but I could see her fighting down her maternal impulse to go scoop Mandy out of the creek immediately.
I know I met her last night, but I'm not sure I remember Fanny. Where does she live?
With us, Jamie said matter-of-factly.
Ow!
Hold still, I said, spreading the puncture wound in his leg open with two fingers while I poured saline solution into it. You don't want to die of tetanus, do you?
And what would you do if I said yes, Sassenach?
The same thing I'm doing right now. I don't care if you want to or not. I'm not having it.
Well, why did you ask me then?
He leaned back on his palms, both legs stretched out, and looked up at Bree.
Fanny's a wee orphan, lass. Your brother took her under his protection.
Bree's face went almost comically blank.
My brother? Willie? She asked, tentative. Unless your mother cares otherwise, he's the only brother you've got, Jamie assured her.
Aye,
William. Jesus, Sassenach, you're worse than the bear.
He closed his eyes, whether to avoid looking at what I was doing to his leg, enlarging and debriding the wound with a lancet. The injury wasn't serious in itself, but the puncture wound in his calf was deep, and I was, in fact, not being rhetorical about the risk of tetanus, or to give Bree a moment to recover her countenance. She looked at him, head cocked to one side.
So, she said slowly, that means he knows that you're his father.
Jamie grimaced, not opening his eyes.
He does.
Not that happy about it. One side of her mouth curled up, but both her eyes and her voice were sympathetic.
Probably not.
Yet, I murmured, rinsing blood down his long shinbone. He snorted. Bree made a more feminine version of the same noise and went to fetch the whiskey. Jamie heard her go and opened his eyes.
Are you not done yet, Sassenach?
I saw the slight vibration of his wrists and realized that he was bracing himself on his palms in order to hide the fact that he was trembling with exhaustion.
I'm through hurting you, I assured him.
I put my hand next to his on the log as I rose, touching his fingers lightly.
I'll put a bandage on it, and then you should lie down for a bit with your foot propped up.
Don't fall asleep, da. Brianna's shadow fell over him, and she leaned down to hand him the canteen. Ian says he's bringing Rachel and his mother down to have supper with us. She leaned in farther and kissed him on the forehead.
Don't worry about Willie, she said. He'll figure things out. I hope he doesn't wait till I'm dead.
He gave her a lopsided smile to indicate that this was meant to be a joke, and lifted the canteen in salute. I chivied Jamie, protesting, into the shade under my surgical shelter, and made him lie down with my apron folded under his head.
Have you had anything to eat at all since breakfast?
I asked, propping his injured leg up with a chunk of wood from the scrap heap.
I have, he said patiently. Amy Higgins sent bannocks and cheese with Brianna, and we ate it while waiting on the bear to leave. Do you think I'd not have said by now if I was starving?
Oh, I said, feeling rather foolish. Well, yes, I do. It's just... I smoothed hair back from his brow.
It's just that I want to make you feel better, and feeding you was the only thing that came to mind.
That made him laugh, and he stretched, arching his back, and readjusted himself into a more comfortable position on the trampled grass.
Well, that's a kind thought, Sassenach. I could think of a few other things, maybe, after I've had a few rest.
And Brianna says that Ian's lot are coming to supper. He turned his head, casting a look toward the distant mountains where the sun was coming slowly down through a scatter of fat little clouds, painting their bellies with soft gold.
We both sighed a little at the sight, and he turned and took my hand.
What I want you to do, Sassenach, is to sit wee me here for a moment and tell me I'm no dreaming. She's really here. She and the bairns and Roger Mac.
I squeezed his hand and felt the same bubbling joy I could see in his face.
It's real.
They're here. Right there, in fact. I laughed a little, because I could still see Brianna below, just heading for the trees that fringed the creek, her long hair loose now, fading to brown in the shadows and lifting in the evening breeze as she called for the children.
I know what you mean, though. I had a visit with Roger this morning and asked him to let me examine his throat. I felt just like Doubting Thomas. It was so strange to have him right there in front of me, touch him, and at the same time, it didn't seem strange at all. I rubbed the back of his hand lightly with my thumb, feeling the knobs of his knuckles and the faint roughness of the scar that ran down from where his fourth finger had been.
I feel like that all the time, Sassenach, he said, his voice a little husky.
His fingers curled over mine.
When I wake sometimes in the early morning, and I see you there beside me, I doubt you're real, until I touch you, or until you fart.
I yanked my hand loose and he rolled away and came up sitting, elbows hunched comfortably over his knees.
So, how is it with Roger Mac? He asked, ignoring my glare. Do you think he'll ever have his voice back?
I don't know, I said. I truly don't. But let me tell you what he told me about a man named Hector McEwen. He listened with great attention, stirring only to brush away wandering clouds of gnats.
Have you ever seen that yourself, Ian? He asked when I'd finished. Blue light, as he said.
A small, deep shiver went through me that had nothing to do with the cooling air. I looked away to a buried past, or one I'd tried to bury. Well, yes, I said, and swallowed. But I thought I was hallucinating at the time, and it's quite possible I was. I'm reasonably sure that I was actually dying, and imminent death might alter one's perceptions.
Aye, it does, he said rather dryly. But that's not to say what you see in such a state, isn't it true?
He looked closely at my face, considering.
You dinna need to tell me, he continued quietly, and touched my shoulder. There's no need to live such things again if they dinna come back of their own accord.
No, I said, maybe a little too quickly. I cleared my throat and took a firm grip on mind and memory. I won't. It's just that I had a bad infection, and Master Raymond. I wasn't looking directly at him, but I felt his head lift suddenly at the name. He came and healed me. I don't have any idea how he did it, and I wasn't thinking anything consciously, but I saw. I rubbed a hand slowly over my forearm, seeing it again. It was blue, the bone inside my arm. Not a vivid blue, not like that. I gestured toward the mountain where the evening sky above the clouds had gone the colour of larkspur. A very soft, faint blue. But it did. Glow isn't the right word, really. It was alive. It had been. And I'd felt the blue spread outward from my bones, wash through me, and felt the bursting of the microbes in my system dying like stars.
The remembered sense of it lifted the hairs on my arms and neck and filled me with a strange sensation of well-being, like warm honey being stirred. A wild cry from the woods above broke the mood, and Jamie turned, smiling. "Och, that's wee Oggy. He sounds like a hunting catamount." I got to my feet, brushing grass off my skirt. "I think he's the loudest child I've ever heard." As though the shriek had been a signal, I heard hooting from the hollow below, and a gang of children burst out of the trees by the creek, followed by Bree and Roger, walking slowly, heads leaning toward each other, deep in what looked like contented conversation.
"I'm going to need a bigger house," Jamie said meditatively.
Before he could expand on this interesting notion, though, the Murrays appeared on the path that led down from the eastern side of the ridge, Rachel carrying Oggy, bellowing over her shoulder, and Ian behind her with a large covered basket. "The children," Rachel said to Jamie. Jamie stood up, smiling, then nodded toward the clearing below.
"See for yourself and Ian."
Jem, Mandy and Germain had been sorted out from their companions and were now tagging along behind Bree and Roger, amicably pushing one another.
"Oh,"
Rachel said very softly, and I saw her hazel eyes go soft as well.
"Oh, Jamie,
thy daughter looks so like thee.
And her son as well."
"I told you,"
Ian said, smiling down at her, and she put a hand on his arm, squeezing tight.
"Thy mother."
Rachel shook her head, unable to think of anything sufficiently descriptive of Jenny's emotional state.
"Well, I doubt she'll faint away," Jamie said, getting gingerly to his feet. "She's met the lass once before, though no the bairns. Where is she, though?"
He glanced up the path that led into the woods as though expecting his sister to materialize there as he spoke.
"She's staying at the McNeils tonight," Rachel said, and set Oggy on the grass where he lay squirming in a leisurely manner. "She and Kirstina McNeil became very friendly while we were quilting, and Kirstina told us that her husband has gone to Salisbury, and she was frightened at the thought of being alone at night, their home being such a distance from their nearest neighbour."
I nodded at that. Kirstina was very young, newly married. She was Richard McNeil's third wife, and had come from Campbelltown near Cross Creek. Night on a mountain was very dark and full of things unseen.
"That was very kind of Jenny," I said.
Ian gave a brief snort of amusement.
"I'll no say my mother isn't a kind," he said, "but I'll give you good odds that she's staying on her own account as much as Mistress McNeil's."
He nodded at Oggy, who was whining, a long trail of drool hanging from his lower lip. "The laddie's had the colic 3 nights running, and it's a small cabin, eh? I'll wager you 3-1 she's stretched out like a corpse on Mrs. McNeil's bed right now. Sound asleep."
"She walked the floor with him half the night," Rachel said apologetically to me. "I told her I would take him, but she said, pish, and what's a granny for then?"
She squatted and picked up Oggy before he could escalate to his imitation of an air raid siren.
"What does he think of Marmaduke, Clare?"
"Of... oh, as a name for Oggy, you mean?"
I hastily rearranged my face, but it was too late. Rachel laughed.
"That's what Jenny said. Still," she added, removing the end of her dark plait from her son's grasping fingers, "Marmaduke Stevenson was one of the Boston martyrs. A very weighty friend. He would be a fine name."
"Well, I grant you, he wouldn't easily be mistaken for someone else if you call him Marmaduke," Jamie said, trying to be tactful. "And he'd learn to fight early on. But if you mean him to be a Quaker..." "Aye," said Ian to Rachel, "and we're no calling him Fear the Lord either, lass. Maybe Fortitude, though, that's a decent manly name."
"Mmm," she said, looking down her nose at her offspring.
"What does he think of Wisdom? Wisdom Murray? Wisdom Ian Murray?"
Ian laughed.
Aye, and what if the laddie should turn out to be a fool? Borrowing trouble, are you know?
Jamie tilted his head and squinted at Oggy, considering, then glanced at Ian, then at Rachel, and shook his head.
Given his parents, I dinna think that's likely. Still, have you thought perhaps to honour your own da, Rachel? What was your father's name?
Mordecai, she said. Possibly not as a first name.
I glanced at the fire, a wavering reddish transparency in the daylight. Ian, would you build up the fire a bit? I'm going to cook the doves in the ashes and then... I glanced back down the hill, counting heads as they came up. The Higgins children had peeled off and gone to their own cabin for supper. So that left us with, I counted quickly on my fingers, 7 adults, 4 children. And I had a big pot of lentils with herbs and a ham bone that had been bubbling since midday. Bree had skinned and cleaned the squirrels she'd brought back. Perhaps I'd best cut them up and add them to the pot, and then...
We brought thee a small addition to thy supper, Claire.
Rachel nodded toward the basket over her arm.
No, Oggy, thee mustn't pull thy mother's hair. I might be startled and drop thee into the fire, and that would be a dreadful shame, wouldn't it?
I laughed at this very Quaker threat, but Oggy let go, mostly, the end of his mother's braid, and stuffed his fist into his mouth instead, regarding me with a thoughtful stare. Come on, I said, reaching for him. You've got cousins to meet, young Oglethorpe. Jamie's leg didn't hurt a great deal, but it was bruised and tender, and he was happy to sit on the big stump near Claire's makeshift surgery and let his bones rest as he watched his family busy with making dinner. Brianna was dealing with the shattered deer, still wearing the hunting clothes he'd lent her. He watched her sure hand with the knife and the power of her shoulders working. Proud of her. Did she take that skill from himself, he wondered, or from her mother? It wasn't only the hands, nor yet the simple knowledge of how to go about it. It was a toughness of mind, he thought approvingly, the recognition of a job to do and no need to question it. He glanced at Roger, who was splitting wood, stripped to the waist and sweating. That lad did have questions, and likely always would. Jamie thought he maybe sensed a new determination in him, though. He'd need it. Claire said he meant to go on with being a minister. That was good. Folk needed someone to do for their souls, and Roger plainly needed something worth doing. Claire said he'd told her he'd thought about it and made up his mind. Brianna, though, what might the shape of her life be here now? She'd taught a bit in their wee school when she was here on the ridge before. He hadn't thought she really liked teaching, though. He thought she wouldn't miss it. She rose to her feet as he watched, and stretched, arms reaching for the sky. Christ, she's a braw lass. Maybe she'll have more children. He was almost afraid to think that. He didn't want to risk her. And Jem and Mandy needed her. Still and all. The thought was a small green hope in his chest, and he smiled, watching the knot of children bringing up firewood, dropping it on the ground and running off to join the game or whatever they were playing. Hide and seek, perhaps. There was wee Frances coming along with a bundle of sticks and a handful of flowers. She'd lost her cap, and her dark curls had come down on one side, straggling over one shoulder. Her face was pink with the exercise, and she was smiling. He was happy to see it. Something tickled his leg, breaking into his thoughts. There was a green thing that looked like a tiny spade sitting on his upraised knee. He moved a hand cautiously toward it, but it wasn't afraid of him, and didn't fly off or retaliate by trying to crawl into his ears or nose as flies did. It let him touch its backside, merely twitching its antenna in mild annoyance. But when he attempted to stroke its back, it sprang off his knee, sudden as a grasshopper, and landed on the edge of Claire's medicine box, where it seemed to pause to take stock of the circumstances.
Don't do it, he advised the insect in Gaelic. You'll end up as a tonic, or ground to powder.
He couldn't tell whether it was looking at him, but it seemed to consider, then gave another startling hop, and vanished. Fanny had brought Claire a plant of some kind, and Claire was turning over the leaves, her face bright with interest, explaining what it was good for. Fanny glowed, a tiny smile of pleasure at being useful on her face. The sight of her warmed his heart. She'd been so frightened when Willie brought her to them. And nay wonder, poor wee lass. There was a colder place in his heart where her sister Jane lived. He said a small prayer for the repose of Jane's soul, and, after an instant's hesitation, another for Willie. Whenever he thought of Jane, he saw her in his mind, alone and abandoned in black night, her face stark white, dead, by the light of her only candle. Dead by her own hand, and the church said thus damned, but he stubbornly prayed for her soul anyway. They couldn't stop him. Been a fascia linen, he thought toward her tenderly. I'll see Francis see for you, and maybe I'll see you in heaven one day. Dinna be afraid. He hoped someone would see William safe for him. Dreadful as the memory of that night was, he kept it, recalled it deliberately. William had come to him for help, and he treasured that. The sense of the two of them pursuing a lost cause through a rainy, dangerous night, standing together in desolation by the light of that candle, too late. It was a dreadful memory, but one he didn't want to forget. Mammy, he thought, his mother coming suddenly to mind.
Look after my bonny lad, will you?
Chapter 7
Dead or Alive.
William, 9th Earl of Ellesmere, Viscount Ashness, Baron Derwent, leaned against an oak tree, taking stock of his resources. At the moment, these consisted of a fairly good horse, a nice dark bay with a white nose, who, William had been informed by the horse's prior owner, went by the name of Bartholomew, along with a canvas sack containing a discouragingly small amount of food, and half a bottle of stale beer, a decent knife, and a musket that might, in a pinch, be used to club someone, because attempting to fire it would undoubtedly blow off William's hand, face, or both. He did have £3, 7 shillings, tuppence, and a handful of small coins, and fragments of metal that might once have been coins. A beneficent side effect of scraping acquaintance with an American militia unit he'd encountered at a roadside tavern. They had, they said, served with the Continental troops at Monmouth and had been with General Washington 6 months earlier at Middlebrook Encampment, the last known place that William's cousin Benjamin had been seen alive. Whether Benjamin was still alive was a matter of considerable speculation, but William was determined to proceed on that assumption until, and unless he found proof to the contrary. His encounter with the New Jersey militiamen had yielded no information whatever in that regard, but it had produced a number of men eager to play at cards, who grew wilder in their wages as the night wore on and the drink ran low. William hoped he'd find some place tonight where the money he'd won might buy him supper and a bed. At the moment it seemed much more likely to get him killed. He discovered that dawn was often the time for regrets, and apparently the Americans shared that sentiment today. They'd woken bellicose rather than nauseated, though, and had shortly thereafter accused William of cheating at cards, thus causing him to take his leave abruptly. He peered cautiously out through the drooping canopy of a white oak. The road ran by a furlong or so from his hiding place, and while it was blessedly vacant at the moment, the muddy track was clearly well travelled, pocked and churned by the recent passage of horses. He'd heard them coming, thank God, in time to get Bart off the road and hidden in a tangle of saplings and vines. He'd crept closer to the road just in time to see some of the men from whom he'd won money the night before, now halfway recovered from their sodden sleep, and of a mind to get it back, judging from their incoherent shouts as they passed. He glanced up at the flickering green light that came down through the leaves. It was no more than mid-morning. Too bad. He didn't think it wise to go back to the tavern where the other militiamen were doubtless stirring, and he had no idea how far it might be to the next hamlet. He shifted his weight and sighed. He didn't fancy hanging about under a tree, which, it struck him, was the perfect size and shape from which to hang a man, until the lot pursuing him got tired and went back the other way, or nightfall, whichever came first. What came next was the sound of horses, but fewer of them. Three men, riding slowly. Cloaca Obscena. He didn't say it aloud, but the words rang clear in his head. One of the men was the gentleman from whom he'd purchased bark 2 days before, and the others were from the militia unit. The other thing that was clear to him was the vision of Bart's right fore, on which the shoe was missing a large triangular chunk. He didn't wait to see whether the ex-owner could pick Bart's track out of the morass in the road. He dodged round the oak and made his way as fast as he could through the brush, devil take the noise. Bart, whom he'd left nosing about for edibles, was standing with his head up, ears pricked and nostrils flared with interest. "No," William said in a frantic whisper. "Don't!" The horse neighed loudly. William snatched loose the reins and swung up into the saddle, gathering both reins into one hand and reaching for the musket with the other. "Go!" he shouted, kicking Bart smartly, and they broke through the screen of brush and slewed onto the road in a shower of leaves and mud. The three riders had gathered at the edge of the road, one man squatting in the mud, looking at the mass of overlapping tracks. All of them turned to gape at William, who bellowed something incoherent at them, and brandished his musket as he turned sharply to the left and charged back in the direction of the tavern, bent low over his horse's neck. He could hear shouted curses behind him, but he had a good lead. He might make it. As to what might happen if he did, it didn't matter. There wasn't anything else he could do. Being trapped between two groups of hostile horsemen didn't appeal to him. Bart stumbled, slipped in the mud, and went down. William, shooting off over his head and landing flat on his back with a splat that knocked the breath out of him and the musket out of his hand. They were on him before he could remember how to breathe. His head swam, and everything was a blur of moving shapes. Two of the men dragged him up, and he hung between them, blood roaring in his ears, helplessly vibrating with fury and fear, mouth opening and closing like a goldfish. They didn't waste time in threats. Bart's ex-owner punched him in the face, and the others let go, dropping him back into the mud. Hands rifled his pockets, snatched the knife from his belt. He heard Bart waffling nearby, stamping a bit as one of the men pulled at the saddle.
"Oi, you let that alone," shouted Bart's owner, standing up. "That's my horse and my saddle, damn your eyes."
"No, it isn't," said a determined voice. "You'd not caught this rascal without us. I'm having the saddle."
"Leave it, Lowell. Let him have his horse. We'll share out the money."
A third man evidently belted Lowell to emphasize his opinion, for there was a meaty smack and a yelp of outrage. William suddenly remembered how to breathe, and the dark mist cleared from his vision. Panting shallowly, he rolled over and started trying to get his feet under him. One of the men cast him a brief glance, but clearly thought him no threat. "I'm probably not," he thought muzzily, but he wasn't used to losing fights, and the thought of simply slinking off like a whipped dog wasn't on either. His musket had fallen into the thick flowering grass along the road. He wiped blood out of one eye, stood up, picked up the gun, and clubbed Bart's ex-owner in the back of the head with it. The man had been in the act of mounting, and his foot stuck in the stirrup as he fell. The horse shied and backed with a shrill whinny of protest, and the men who'd been engaged in dividing William's substance jerked around in alarm. One leapt back and the other lunged forward, grabbing the musket's barrel, and there were a few seconds of panting confusion, interrupted by the sound of shouts and galloping horses. Distracted,
William glanced round to see the larger group of gamblers from last night bearing down on them hell for leather. He let go of the musket and dived for the grassy verge. He would have made it had Bart, frightened by the onrush and the insensible weight still dangling from his stirrup, not chosen the same moment and the same goal. 900 pounds of panicked horseflesh sent William flying down the road, where he landed on his face. The ground shook round him, and he could do nothing more than cover his head and pray. There was a great deal of splashing, shouting, and impact. William suffered a passing kick in the ribs and a jarring thump to the left buttock as the fight...
Why are they fighting?
He thought dizzily, raged over and past him. Then the shooting started. His position couldn't easily be improved. He went on, lying in the road, arms covering his head, as men shouted and cursed in alarm. More horses came galloping toward him, and the rolling fire of muskets crashed over said head.
Rolling fire, he thought suddenly,
because that's what it bloody was. And he rolled over and sat up in amazement to see a company of British infantry, some efficiently rounding up persons attempting to flee the scene, others efficiently reloading their muskets, and two officers on horseback surveying the scene with an attitude of fierce interest. He palmed mud away from his eyes and stared hard at the officers. Reasonably sure he didn't know either of them, he relaxed slightly. He wasn't injured, but the impact of Bart's collision had left him shaken and bruised. He went on sitting in the middle of the road, breathing and letting his brain begin to restore its relations with his body. The altercation, such as it was, had died down. The soldiers had rounded up most of the men he'd been gambling with and prodded them with bayonets into a small group where a young cornet was efficiently tying their hands behind them.
You,
said a voice behind him, and a boot nudged him roughly in the ribs.
Get up.
He turned his head to see that he was being addressed by a private, an older man with a good deal of assurance about him. Quite suddenly it occurred to him that the infantrymen might suppose him to be a participant in the recent fracas, rather than its victim. He scrambled to his feet and stared down at the much shorter private, who took a step back and flushed red.
Put your hands behind you.
No, William said briefly, and, turning his back on the man, took a step toward the mounted officers. The private, affronted, lunged at him and seized him by the arm. Take your hands off me, William said, and the private, ignoring this civil request, shoved him and sent him staggering.
Stand still, damn your eyes, stand or I'll shoot.
William turned again to find another private, hot-faced and sweating, pointing a musket at him. The musket was primed and loaded, and it was William's musket. His mouth dried.
Don't shoot, he managed. That gun, it's not...
The first private stepped up behind him and punched him solidly in the kidney. His insides clenched as though he'd been stabbed in the stomach, and his vision went white. He gave at the knees, but didn't quite fall down, instead curling up on himself like a dead leaf.
That one, said an educated English voice, penetrating the buzzing white fog. That one, and this one, the tall fellow. Stand him up.
Hands seized William's shoulders and yanked them back. He could scarcely breathe, but he made a strangled noise. Through a haze of tears and mud, he saw one of the officers, still on horseback, looking down at him critically.
Yes, the officer said. Hang that one, too.
William examined his handkerchief critically. There wasn't much left of it. They'd tried to bind his wrists with it, and he'd ripped it to shreds getting it off. Still... He blew his nose on it very gently, still bloody, and he dabbed the seepage gingerly. Footsteps were coming up the tavern stairs toward the room where he sat, guarded by two wary privates.
He says he's who? Said an annoyed voice outside the room.
Someone said something in reply, but it was lost in the scraping of the door across the uneven floor as it opened. He rose slowly to his feet and drew himself up to his full height,
facing the officer, a major of dragoons, who had just come in. The major stopped abruptly, forcing the two men behind him to stop as well.
"He says he's the fucking ninth Earl of Ellesmere," William said in a hoarse, menacing tone, fixing the major with the eye that he could still open.
"Actually, he is," said a lighter voice, sounding both amused and familiar. William blinked at the man who now stepped into the room, a slender, dark-haired figure in the uniform of a captain of infantry.
"Captain Lord Ellesmere, in fact."
"Hello, William."
"I've resigned my commission," William said flatly.
"Hello, Dennis."
"But not your title."
Dennis Randall looked him up and down, but forbore to comment on his appearance.
"Resigned your commission, have you?"
The major, a youngish, thick-set fellow who looked as though his breeches were too tight, gave William an unpleasant look.
"In order to turn your coat and join the rebels, I take it."
William breathed twice in order to avoid saying anything rash.
"No,"
he said in an unfriendly voice.
"Naturally not," Dennis said, gently rebuking the major.
He turned back to William. "And naturally, you would have been travelling with a company of American militia because..."
"I was not travelling with them," William said, successfully not adding "unit" to this statement. "I encountered the gentlemen in question last night at a tavern and won a substantial amount from them at cards. I left the tavern early this morning and resumed my journey, but they followed me, with the obvious intent of taking back the money by force."
"Obvious intent?" echoed the major sceptically.
"How did you discern such intent?"
"Sir," he added reluctantly, "I'd imagine that being pursued and beaten to a pulp might have been a fairly unambiguous indication," Dennis said. "Sit down, Ellesmere, you're dripping on the floor. Did they, in fact, take back the money?"
He pulled a large snowy white handkerchief from his sleeve and handed it to William.
"Yes. Along with everything else in my pockets. I don't know what's become of my horse."
He dabbed the handkerchief against his split lip. He could smell Randall's cologne on it, despite his swollen nose. The real eau de cologne, smelling of Italy and sandalwood. Lord John used it now and then, and the scent comforted him a little.
"So you claim to know nothing of the men with whom we found you?"
said the other officer, this one a lieutenant, a man of about William's own age, eager as a terrier.
The major gave him a look of dislike, indicating that he didn't think he needed any assistance in questioning William,
but the lieutenant wasn't attending.
"Surely, if you were playing cards with them, you must have gleaned some information?"
"I know a few of their names," William said, feeling suddenly very tired. "That's all." That was actually not all, by a long chalk, but he didn't want to talk about the things he'd learned, that Abbott was a blacksmith, and had a clever dog who helped him at his forge, fetching small tools or faggots for the fire when asked. Justin Martineau had a new wife, to whose bed he longed to return. Geoffrey Gardner's wife made the best beer in the village, and his daughter's was nearly as good, though she was but 12 years old. Gardner was one of the men the major had chosen to hang. He swallowed, his throat thick with dust and unspoken words. He'd escaped the noose largely because of his skill at cursing in Latin, which had disconcerted the major long enough for William to identify himself, his ex-regiment, and a list of prominent army officers who would vouch for him, beginning with General Clinton. God, where was Clinton now? Dennis Randall was murmuring to the major, who still looked displeased, but had dropped from a full boil to a disgruntled simmer. The lieutenant was watching William intently through narrowed eyes, obviously expecting him to leap from the bench and make a run for it. The man kept unconsciously touching his cartridge box and then his holstered pistol, clearly imagining the wonderful possibility that he could shoot William dead as he ran for the door. William yawned hugely and unexpectedly, and sat blinking, exhaustion washing through him like the tide. Right this moment, he really didn't care what happened next. His bloody fingers had made smears on the worn wood of the table, and he stared at these in absorption, paying no attention to what was being said, until one battered ear picked up the word intelligencer. He closed his eyes. No. Just no. But he was listening again, despite himself. The voices rose, overlay each other, interrupted, but he was paying attention now, and realized that Dennis was attempting to convince the Major that he, William, was working as a spy, gaining information from American militia groups as part of a scheme to kidnap George Washington. The Major appeared as startled as William was to hear this. The voices dropped as the Major turned his back toward William, leaning forward into Dennis and hissing questions. Dennis, damn him, didn't turn a hair, but he had lowered his voice respectfully. Where the bloody hell was George Washington? He couldn't possibly be within 200 miles, could he? Bar the battle at Monmouth Courthouse, the last William had heard of Washington's movements, he was asking about in the mountains of New Jersey. The last place his cousin Benjamin had been seen. There were noises outside the tavern. Well, there had been all the time. But they were the inchoate noises of men being herded, orders, trampling, protests. Now the sounds took on a more organized character, and he recognized the noises of departure. A raised voice of authority dismissing troops. Men moving away in a body. But not soldiers. Nothing orderly about the shuffling and muttering he heard beneath the nearer sound of Dennis's discussion with Major Whatnot. No telling what was happening. But it didn't sound at all like an official hanging. He'd attended one such function 3 years before, when an American captain named Hale had been executed as a spy. He hadn't eaten any breakfast, and tasted bile as the word dropped like cold lead into his stomach. Thank you, Dennis Randall, he thought, and swallowed. He'd once thought of Dennis as a friend, and while he'd been disabused of that notion 3 years ago by Dennis's abrupt disappearance from Quebec, leaving William snowbound and without purpose, he hadn't quite thought the man would use him openly as a tool. But a tool for what purpose? Dennis seemed to have won his point. The Major turned and gave William a narrow-eyed assessing look, then shook his head, turned and left, followed by his reluctantly obedient lieutenant. Dennis stood quite still, listening to their footsteps recede down the stairs. Then he took a deep, visible breath, straightened his coat, and came and sat down opposite William. "Isn't this a tavern?" William said before Dennis could speak. "It is." One dark brow went up. "Then get me something to drink before you start telling me what the devil you just did to me." The beer was good, and William felt a qualm on behalf of Geoffrey Gardner, but there was nothing he could do for the man. He drank thirstily, ignoring the sting of alcohol on his split lip, and began to feel a little more settled in himself. Dennis had been applying himself to his own beer with an equal intensity, and for the first time, William had enough attention to spare to notice the deep coating of dust that streaked Dennis's wide cuffs and the grubbiness of his linen. He'd been riding for days. It occurred to him to wonder whether perhaps Dennis's opportune appearance hadn't been entirely an accident. But if not, why? And how? Dennis drained his mug and set it down, eyes closed and mouth half open, with momentary content. Then he sighed, sat up straight, opened his eyes and shook himself into order. "Ezekiel Richardson," he said. "When did you last see him?" That wasn't what he'd been expecting. William wiped his mouth gingerly on his sleeve and lifted one brow and his empty mug at the waiting barmaid, who took both mugs and disappeared down the stairs. "To speak to," he said, "a week or two before Monmouth, maybe a year ago. I wouldn't talk to him, though." "Why?"
Mention of Richardson annoyed him. The man had, according to Dennis, he reminded himself, deliberately sent him into the Great Dismal Swamp with an eye to having him abducted or killed by rebels in Dismal Town. He'd nearly died in the swamp, and mention of the man made him more than edgy.
"He's turned his coat," Dennis said bluntly. "I suspected him of being an American agent for some time, but it wasn't until he sent you into the swamp that I began to feel sure of it. But I had no proof, and it's a dangerous business to accuse an officer of spying without it."
"And now you have proof?" Dennis gave him a sharp look.
"He's left the army, without the nicety of resigning, I might add, and showed up in Savannah in the winter, claiming to be a Continental Army major. I think that might be considered sufficient proof."
"If it is, then, what? Is there anything to eat in this place? I hadn't any breakfast."
Dennis looked closely at him, but then rose to his feet without comment, and went downstairs, presumably in search of food. William was, in fact, very light-headed, but wanted also a few moments to come to terms with his revelation. His father knew Richardson slightly. That was how William had first come to take on small intelligencing missions for him. Uncle Hal had, like most soldiers, thought intelligencing not a suitable activity for a gentleman, but Papa hadn't shown any reservations about it. It was also Papa who'd introduced him to Dennis Randall, who'd been calling himself Randall Isaacs at the time. He'd spent some months with Randall Isaacs in Quebec, poking about to little apparent end, before Dennis had abruptly gone off on some undisclosed mission, leaving in William with an Indian guide. Dennis was most certainly... For the first time, the absolute conviction that Dennis was a spy, and the notion that Papa himself might have been one, floated into his head. By reflex, he thumped the heel of his hand against his temple in an order to dislodge the idea, but it wouldn't go. Savannah. In the winter. The British Army had taken the city in late December. He'd been there himself soon after, and had good cause to remember it. His throat thickened. Jane. Voices below, and Dennis's footsteps coming back up. William touched his nose. It was tender and felt about twice its normal size, but it had quit bleeding. Dennis came in, smiling in reassurance.
"Food is on the way, and more beer, unless you need something stronger."
He peered closely at William, made a decision, and turned on his heel.
"I'll get some brandy."
"That can wait."
"What, if anything, has Ezekiel Richardson got to do with my father?" William demanded abruptly.
That froze Dennis, but only momentarily. He moved to the table and sat down slowly, his eyes fixed on William with a distinct look of calculation. Calculations. William could actually see thoughts flitting through the man's mind. He just couldn't tell what any of them were. Dennis took a deep breath and placed both hands on the table, palms down, as though bracing himself.
"What makes you think he has anything to do with Lord John?"
"He, Lord John, I mean, knows the fellow. Richardson approached him with a notion that I should keep an eye out for interesting bits of information."
"I see," Dennis said very dryly. "Well, if they were friends, I should say that such a relationship no longer exists between them. Richardson was heard to utter certain threats regarding your father, though he has apparently not chosen to act on them."
"Yet," he added delicately.
"What sort of threats?"
A spurt of angry alarm had shot up William's spine at this, and blood surged painfully into his battered face.
"I'm sure they are unfounded," Dennis began.
William half rose to his feet.
"Bloody tell me, or I'll pull your fucking nose off."
He reached out, swollen knuckles poised to do just that, and Dennis shoved his bench back with a screech and stood up fast.
"I'll make allowances for your condition, Ellesmere," he said, giving William a firm look of the sort people tried on a dog that threatened to bite. "But..."
William made a noise low in his throat. Dennis took an involuntary step back.
"All right," he snapped.
Richardson threatened to make it known that Lord John is a sodomite. William blinked, frozen for a moment. The word didn't even make sense immediately. Then it did, but he was prevented from saying anything by the entrance of the barmaid, a plump, harassed-looking girl with a squint in one eye, bearing a massive tray of food and drink. The scent of roast meat, buttered vegetables, and fresh bread hurt the membranes of his nose but made his stomach convulse in sudden urgency. Not urgent enough to take his attention off what Randall had just said, though. And William rose, bowed the girl out, and shut the door of the chamber firmly upon her before turning back to Dennis.
A what? That's... William made a wide gesture indicating the complete unbelievability of this.
He was married, for God's sake.
So I understand. To the, merry widow of a Scotch rebel general. That was quite recent, though, wasn't it?
The edge of Dennis Randall's mouth tucked in a little in amusement, which incensed William.
I don't mean that, he snapped. And he wasn't... I mean, the bloody Scotchman's not dead. It was some sort of mistake. My father was married for years to my mother. I mean, my stepmother. To a lady from the Lake District.
He huffed air, angry, and sat down.
Richardson can't do us any damage with that sort of lying gossip.
Dennis pursed his lips and exhaled slowly.
William, he said patiently, gossip has probably killed more men than musket fire. Rubbish!
Dennis smiled a little and acknowledged the exaggeration with a slight shrug.
That might be stating it a bit high, but think about it. You know the value of a man's word, of his character. If Major Albright hadn't taken my word at face value just now, you'd be dead.
He pointed a long manicured finger at William.
What if someone had earlier told him that I made my living cheating at cards, or was the principal investor in a popular bawdy house? Would he have been so inclined to accept my testimony as to the soundness of your character?
William eyed him sceptically, but there was something in it.
Who steals my purse, steals trash, sort of thing?
The smile widened.
But he that filches from me my good name robs me of that which not enriches him, and makes me poor indeed.
Yes, that sort of thing. Consider what gossip of the sort Zeke Richardson has in mind could do to your family, will you? And meanwhile, stop glowering at me and eat something.
William reluctantly considered it. His nose had quit bleeding, but there was an iron taste in the back of his throat. He cleared it and spat, as politely as possible, into the rags of his handkerchief, keeping Dennis's more substantial contribution for mopping up.
All right. I see what you're saying, he said gruffly.
A friend of your father's, a Major Bates, was convicted of sodomy and hanged some years ago, Dennis said. Your father chose to be present at the hanging. He clung to the Major's legs to hasten his death. I don't suppose he would have mentioned that incident to you, though.
William made a small negative motion of the head. He was momentarily too shocked to say anything.
There is a death of the soul as well as death of the body, you know. Even if he were not arrested, nor tried and convicted, a man so accused might well lose his life as it presently exists.
This was said quietly, almost offhandedly, and Dennis followed this remark by sitting up straight, picking up a spoon, and placing before William a pewter plate piled with slices of roast pork, fried squash with corn, and several thick slices of cornbread, then pouring a generous cup of brandy to go with it.
Eat, Dennis repeated firmly, and then, with an eye toward William's general bedragglement, tell me what in the name of God you've been doing. What made you resign your commission to begin with?
None of your business, William said brusquely. As to what I'm doing...
He was tempted to say that that was none of Dennis's business either, but he couldn't overlook Dennis's possibilities as a source of information. It was, after all, an intelligencer's job to find things out. If you must know, I'm looking for some trace of my cousin, Benjamin Gray.
Captain Benjamin Gray, he added, of the 34th foot. Do you know him by chance? Dennis blinked, blank-faced, and William felt a small, surprising jolt in the pit of his stomach. The same feeling he got when a fish nibbled his bait.
I've met him, Randall said cautiously. Trace, you said. Has he been lost?
You could say that. He was captured at the Brandywine and held prisoner at a place called Middlebrook Encampment in the Watchung Mountains. My uncle had an official letter from Sir Henry Clinton's clerk, passing on a terse note from the Americans, regretting the death of Captain Benjamin Gray from fever.
Oh.
Dennis relaxed a fraction of an inch, though his eyes were still watchful.
My condolences. You mean that you want to find where your cousin is buried, to, move the body to the family, resting place?
I had that in mind, William said. Only I did find his grave. And he wasn't in it.
A brief recollection of that night in the Watchung Mountains washed over him suddenly, raising the hairs on his forearms. Cold, wet clay clinging to his feet, and rain soaking through his clothes, spongy blisters on his palms, and the smell of death coming up from the ground as his shovel grated suddenly on bone. He turned his head away, both from Dennis and the memory.
Someone else was, though.
Dear Lord.
Dennis reached automatically for his cup, and finding it empty, shook himself briefly as though to dislodge the vision, then reached for the brandy bottle.
You're quite sure? I mean, how long?
He'd been buried for some time.
William took a long, burning gulp of the brandy to purge the memory of the smell and the touch.
But not long enough to hide the fact that the man in that grave had no ears.
Dennis's evident shock gave him a sour satisfaction.
Exactly, he said. A thief. And no, it wasn't a mistaken identification of the body. The grave was marked with the name Gray, and Benjamin's full name was listed in the camp's records of prisoner burials.
Dennis was 12 years older than William, but he looked suddenly older than 33, his fine features sharpened by attention.
You think it was deliberate, then? Well, of course, he interrupted himself impatiently. Naturally it was. But by whom? And to what purpose?
He didn't wait for an answer.
If someone had murdered your cousin and sought to hide his death, why not simply bury him as a fever victim? No need for the substitute body, I mean. So your first supposition is that he's alive. I think that's reasonable.
William drew a breath tinged with relief.
I do too, he said. So then it's one of two possibilities. Ben faked his death and managed to substitute the other body in order to escape without pursuit. Or someone did it for him without his consent and took him away.
I can see the first possibility, but damned if I can think of a reason for the second.
But it doesn't matter that much. If he's alive, I can find him, and I bloody will. The family needs to know one way or another.
This was quite true. He was honest enough to admit to himself, though, that Ben's disappearance had offered him a purpose, a way out of the morass of guilt and sorrow left by Jane's death. Dennis rubbed a hand over his face. It was late in the day, and his whiskers were starting to rasp, a dark shadow over his jaw.
The words needle and haystack come to mind, he said. But theoretically, yes, you could find him, if he's alive.
Definitely, yes, William said firmly. I have a list.
He touched his breast pocket to make sure that he still did have it, but felt the reassuring wadge of folded paper, of men belonging to 2 militia companies who were put on grave-digging detail in Middlebrook Encampment during a fever outbreak.
Oh, so that's what you were doing with...
Yes. Unfortunately, American militia companies enlist only for short periods, and then scatter off to tend their farms. One of the companies was from North Carolina and one from Virginia, but the men last night weren't.
He stopped abruptly, reminded. The men last night. Does Major Albright actually intend to hang some of them? Dennis shrugged.
I don't know him well enough to say. It might have been meant only for effect, to frighten and scatter the rest. But he's taken those three along with him back to his camp. If his temper cools, by the time he gets there, he'll likely have them flogged and let them go. He's got enough men under his command that hanging civilians out of hand would become a matter of record. Not really what an officer with an eye to advancement wants, if he's any sense. Not that Albright gives one the impression that he has, he added thoughtfully.
I see.
Speaking of having no sense, what the devil was that taradiddle about me planning to kidnap George Washington? Randall actually laughed at that, and William felt his ears grow warm. Well, not you personally, he assured William. Just a ruse de guerre. It worked, though, didn't it? And I had to think of some explanation for your outré appearance. Being an intelligencer was the only halfway believable thing I could think of. William grunted and gingerly tried a mouthful of succotash, a fried and buttered mixture of diced squash and corn sliced from the cob. It went down well, and he attacked the rest of his meal with increasing enthusiasm, ignoring the minor discomfort of eating. Dennis watched him, smiling a little as he ate his own meal, but leaving him alone. When the plates were empty, there was a contemplative silence between them, not friendly, but not hostile either. Dennis picked up the brandy bottle and shook it. A small sloshing noise reassured him, and he poured out what was left into their cups, then picked one up and raised it to William. "A bargain," he said. "If you come across any news of Ezekiel Richardson, send word to me. If I hear of anything pertaining to your cousin Benjamin, I'll send word to you." William hesitated for a moment, but then touched his cup firmly to Randall's. "Done." Dennis drank, then set down his cup. "You can send me word in care of Captain Blakeney. He's with Clinton's troops in New York. And if I hear of anything?" William grimaced, but there wasn't a lot of choice. "Care of my father. He and my uncle are with the garrison at Savannah, with Prevost." Dennis nodded, pushed back his bench, and stood up. "All right. Your horse is outside, with your knife and musket. May I ask where you're bound?" "Virginia." He hadn't actually known that for sure until he said it, but the speaking gave him certainty. Virginia. Mount Josiah. Dennis groped in a pocket and laid 2 guineas and a handful of smaller coins on the table. He smiled at William. "It's a long way to Virginia. Consider it a loan." Chapter 8. Visitations. Fraser's Ridge. By mid-afternoon, I'd made great progress with my medicaments. Treated 3 cases of poison ivy rash, a broken toe caused by its owner kicking a mule in a fit of temper, and a raccoon bite, non-rabid. The hunter had knocked the coon out of a tree, thought it was dead, and went to pick it up, only to discover that it wasn't. The raccoon was mad, but not in any infectious sense. Jamie, though, had done much better. People had come up to the house site all day, in a steady trickle of neighbourliness and curiosity. The women had stayed to chat with me about the Mackenzies, and the men had wandered off through the site with Jamie, returning with promises to come and lend a day's labour here and there.
"If Roger, Mark and Ian can help me move lumber tomorrow, the Sinclairs will come the next day and give me a hand with the floor joists. We'll lay the hearthstone and bless it on Wednesday. Sean McHugh and a couple of his lads will lay the floor with me on Friday, and we'll get the framing started next day. Tom McLeod says he can spare me a half day, and Hiram Crombie's son Joe says he and his half-brother can help with that as well."
He smiled at me.
"If the whiskey holds out, you'll have a roof over your head in 2 weeks, Sathanach."
I looked dubiously from the stone foundation to the cloud-flecked sky overhead. "A roof?
Aye, well, a sheet of canvas, most likely," he admitted.
"Still?" He stood and stretched, grimacing slightly. "Why don't you sit down for a bit?" I suggested, eyeing his leg.
He was limping noticeably, and the leg was a vivid patchwork of red and purple, demarcated by the black stitches of my repair job. Amy's left us a jug of beer.
Perhaps a wee bit later, he said. What's that you're making, Sassenach?
I'm going to make up some gallberry ointment for Lizzie Beardsley, and then some gripe water for her little new one. Do you know if he has a name yet?
Hubertus.
What?
Hubertus, he repeated, smiling, or so Kezzy told me the day before yesterday. It's in compliment to Monica's late brother, he says.
Oh. Lizzie's father, Joseph Weems, had taken a kind German lady of a certain age as his second wife, and Monica, having no children of her own, had become a stalwart grandmother to the Beardsley's growing brood. Perhaps they can call him Bertie for short.
Are you out to the Jesuit bark, Sassenach?
He lifted his chin in the direction of the open medicine chest I'd set on the ground near him.
Do you not use that for Lizzie's tonic?
I do, I said, rather surprised that he'd noticed. I used the last of it 3 weeks ago, though, and haven't heard of anyone going to Wilmington or New Bern who might get me more.
Did you mention it to Roger Mack?
No. Why him? I asked, puzzled. Jamie leaned back against the cornerstone, wearing one of those overtly patient expressions that's meant to indicate that the person addressed is not being particularly bright. I snorted and flicked a gallberry at him. He caught it and examined it critically.
Is it edible?
Amy says bees like the flowers, I said dubiously, pouring a large handful of the dark purple berries into my mortar. But there's very likely a reason why they're called gallberries.
Ah.
He tossed it back at me, and I dodged.
You told me yourself, Sassenach, that Roger Max said to you yesterday that he meant to come back to the ministering. So?
He went on patiently, seeing no hint of enlightenment on my face.
What would you do first, if that was your aim?
I scooped a large glob of pale yellow bear grease from its pot into the mortar, part of my mind debating whether to add a decoction of willow bark, while the rest considered Jamie's question. Ah, I said in turn, and pointed my pestle at him. I'd go round to all the people who'd been part of my congregation, so to speak, and let them know that Mac the Knife is back in town. He gave me a concerned look, but then shook his head, dislodging whatever image I'd just given him.
You would, he said, and maybe introduce yourself to the folk who've come to the Ridge since you left.
And within a couple of days, everyone on the Ridge, and probably half the Brethren's choir in Salem, would know about it. He nodded amiably.
Aye, and they'd all ken that you need Jesuit bark, and you'd likely get it within the month.
Are you in need of Jesuit bark, grand-mère? Germain had emerged from the woods behind me, a pail of water in one hand, a bundle of faggots clutched to his chest with the other, and what appeared to be a dead snake hanging round his neck.
Yes, I said.
Is that a... But he'd forgotten me, his attention riveted on his grandfather's macerated leg.
Formidable, he said, dropping the wood. Can I see, grand-père?
Jamie made a gracious, feel-free gesture toward his leg, and Germain bent to look, eyes round.
Mandy said that a bear bit your leg off, he said,
advancing a tentative forefinger toward the line of stitches.
But I didn't believe her. Does it hurt?
He asked, glancing at Jamie's face.
Och, nae bother, Jamie said, with a dismissive wave of the hand. I've a privy to dig later. What kind is your wee snake, then?
Germain obligingly removed the limp serpent and handed it to Jamie, who plainly hadn't expected the gesture, but gingerly accepted it. I smiled and looked down into my mortar. Jamie was afraid of snakes, but manfully disguised the fact, holding it up by the tail. It was a big corn snake, nearly 3 feet of orange and yellow scales, vivid as a streak of lightning.
Did you kill it, Germain?
I frowned at the snake, pausing in my mashing. I'd explained repeatedly to all the children that they ought not to kill any non-venomous snakes, as they helpfully ate mice and rats. But most adults on the Ridge considered that the only good snake was a dead one, and it was an uphill battle.
Oh, no, Connie, he assured me. It was in your garden,
and Fanny went for it with a hoe, but I stopped her. But then your wee chitty slipped through the fence and jumped on it and broke its...
He frowned at the snake.
I didn't ken whether it was its back or its neck, because how could you tell? But it's dead all right. I thought I'd skin it for Fanny, he explained, glancing back over his shoulder toward the garden. To make her a belt, maybe?
What a lovely idea, I said, wondering whether Fanny would think so.
Do you think I might be able to buy a buckle for it from the tinker?
Germain asked Jamie, taking back his snake and redraping it round his neck.
The belt, I mean. I've got tuppence and some wee purple stones to trade.
What tinker? I stopped mashing and stared at him.
Joe Beardsley told me he'd met a tinker in Salem 2 days ago, and he reckoned the man would be here sometime this week,
Germain explained.
He said the tinker got a sack load of simples, so I thought if you needed anything, Granny.
I cast a quick greedy glance at my medicine chest, depleted by a planting season rife with axe and hoe injuries, animal and insect bites, an outbreak of food poisoning, and a strange plague of respiratory illness among the McNeils, accompanied by low fever, coughing, and bluish spots on the trunk. I patted my pockets, wondering what I had to trade, come to think of it.
There are 2 bottles left of the elderberry wine, Jamie said, standing up straight. You can use those, Sassenach, and I've got a good deerskin and half of a wee barrel of turpentine.
No. I want to keep the turpentine, I said, adding absently. Hookworms, you know.
Jamie and Germain exchanged a cynical glance.
Hookworms, Jamie said,
and Germain shook his head. Before I could enlighten them about hookworms, though, a shout came from the direction of the creek, and Duncan Leslie and his 2 sons appeared, one of the sons with a large ham tucked under one arm. Jamie stood up to greet them, and they all nodded politely to me, but didn't seem to expect me to stop what I was doing in order to chat.
I shot a good-sized pig last week, Duncan said, motioning the son with the ham forward. There was a bit to spare, and we thought you might use it, with your family come and all. I'm much obliged, Duncan, Jamie said. If you didn't mind eating under the sky, come and share it with us. Tomorrow? He asked, turning to me.
I shook my head.
Day after tomorrow, I said. I have to go up to Beardsley's tomorrow, and I won't be back in time to make much more than sandwiches. If Amy had made bread and had some to spare, I added silently to myself.
Aye, aye, Duncan said, nodding. My wife will be happy to see you, missus.
So, Jamie, he added, tilting his head toward the foundation, I see you've got a fine big house laid out. 2 chimneys, eh? Where's the kitchen to be, then?
Jamie rose smoothly to his feet, gave me a brief see look over his shoulder, and led the Leslies off to tour the foundation, limping only slightly. Germain laid the snake on my table and saying,
Look after it for me, will you, Granny?
Hurried to join the men. Brianna paused at the top of the trail and blotted sweat from her face and neck. The cabin before them was tidy and neat. Very neat. There were whitewashed stones lining the path that led to the door, and the paned glass windows, glass, were so polished that she could see herself and Roger in them, tiny cut-up blobs of colour amid the green flicker of the reflected forest.
Who whitewashes rocks?
She said, instinctively lowering her voice, as though the cabin might hear her.
Well, can't be someone with a lot of time on their hands, he said, half under his breath. So it's either a frustrated landscape designer or someone with a neurotic need to control their environment.
I suppose there's no reason why you wouldn't find control freaks in any time, she said, shaking dust and leaf fragments off her skirt. Look at the people who designed Elizabethan mazes, I mean. What was it Amy said about these people? Cunningham, is that the name?
Yes, they're Methodists. Blue light, Roger quoted. Be careful of one people, preacher.
And with that he straightened his shoulders and set foot on the path that led between the whitewashed stones.
Blue light, she said,
and followed, poking hastily at her broad-brimmed straw hat, worn sedately over a cap. God forbid the preacher's wife should give scandal to the faithful. The door swung open before Roger could set foot on the step, and a small, bristly man with shaggy grey eyebrows stood eyeing them with no particular look of welcome. He was neatly dressed in butternut homespun breeches and waistcoat, and his linen shirt, while slightly yellowed with age, had been recently ironed.
"Good day to you, sir."
Roger bowed, and Brianna made a brief bob of respect.
"My name is Roger Mackenzie, and this is my wife, Brianna. We've just come lately to the ridge, and..."
"I'd heard."
The man gave them a narrow look, but apparently they passed muster, for the man stepped back, gesturing them in.
"I am Captain Charles Cunningham, Leet of His Majesty's Navy. Come in."
Brianna felt Roger draw a deep breath. She smiled at Captain Cunningham, who blinked and looked sharply at Roger to see if he approved of this.
"Thank you, Captain,"
she said as charmingly as possible, and stepped past Roger and over the threshold.
"You have a most remarkable house. So beautiful."
Why,
the captain began, flustered. Before he could rearrange his thoughts, though, a dark presence manifested itself before the hearth. Now it was Brianna's turn to blink.
"The preacher, are ye?" said the woman, looking past Bree. Yes, it was certainly a woman, though one nearly as tall as Brianna herself, and dressed entirely in black, save for a starched white cap, one of the severe kind with ear lappets. She was old, but no telling how old. Her face was bony and sharp-eyed, and Brianna thought at once of the she-wolf who had suckled Romulus and Remus.
"I am a minister," Roger said, making her a deep bow. "Your servant, madam."
"And what sect might you be, sir?"
the woman demanded.
"I'm a Presbyterian, ma'am," Roger said, "but..."
"And you?"
the woman demanded, fixing Bree with a sharp blue eye.
"Do you share your husband's beliefs?"
"I'm Roman Catholic," Brianna said as mildly as possible. It wasn't the first time, and wouldn't be the last, but they decided early on how to handle such questions.
"Like my father, Jamie Fraser."
That reply normally took the questioner aback and provided enough space for Roger to take control. The non-Catholic tenant's respect for her father, whether based on personal esteem or merely the fact that he was their landlord, usually made them at least amenable to polite conversation, regardless of their general opinion of Catholics. The woman, Mrs. Cunningham, snorted and looked Bree up and down in a way indicating that she'd seen any number of disreputable women in her day and was comparing Brianna unfavourably to the lot of them.
She said, "Poopery, we've nae truck with such things in this house."
"Mother," said the captain, moving toward her,
"I think that..."
"Ma'am," said Roger, stepping in front of Bree in order to intercept the eye of the basilisk being aimed in her direction,
"I assure you we've come neither to proselytize nor to convert ye. I..."
"Presbyterian, you see."
The eye fixed on him, coldly accusing.
"And the minister? How is it, then, that you cannot keep your own wife in order? What sort of minister can you be if you let your woman be a disciple of the Pope, and roam about sowing and watering the seeds of wickedness and disorder amongst your neighbours?"
"Mother," Captain Cunningham said sharply. She didn't flinch, but turned her stern face toward her son.
"You know it's true," she informed him. "This lass,"
she nodded at Brianna,
"says that Jamie Fraser is her sire. That will mean,"
she looked directly at Bree,
"that your mother is Claire Fraser, eh?"
Bree took a deep breath of her own. The cabin was neat as a pin, but quite small, and the supply of air in it seemed to be shrinking by the second.
"She is," she said evenly, "and she asked me to convey her regards to you, and to say that should any member of your family be ill or have an injury, she would be happy to come and attend them. She's a healer and..."
repeated Mrs. Cunningham.
"Aye, I dare say she would, but she'll not get the chance, I assure you, girl.
The instant I heard about the woman, I planted chamomile and holly around the door. Nay witch will set foot in our house, I can tell you.
Bree felt Roger's hand on her arm and gave him a cold side eye. She wasn't about to lose her temper with this woman. His mouth twitched briefly and he let go, turning not to Mrs. Cunningham but to the captain.
As I said, he said pleasantly, I've not come to proselytize. I'm a respecter of sincere belief. I am curious, though. One of my neighbours mentioned the term blue light in reference to you and your family, Captain. I wonder if you'd be willing to tell me the meaning.
Ah, said the captain, sounding cautiously pleased to be asked something that his mother couldn't take issue with.
Well, sir, as you ask, it's the term by which such naval captains as promote the theology of evangelization upon their ships are known. Blue lights, they call us.
He spoke modestly, but his head was proudly raised, as was his chin. His eyes, a paler version of his mother's, were wary, wondering how Roger might take this. Roger smiled.
Are ye a theologian of sort yourself, then, sir?
Oh, said the captain, preening slightly. I wouldn't put it so high, but I have written the occasional piece. Just my own thoughts on the matter, do you see?
Are any of them published, sir? I should be most interested to read your views.
Oh, well, two or three, just small things, of no great merit, I dare say, were published by Bell and Coxham in Edinburgh. I'm afraid I've no copies with me here.
He glanced at a small rough table in the corner that bore a small stack of paper along with an inkwell, sander, and jar of quills.
But I am at work upon an endeavour of a somewhat larger scale.
A book, then?
Roger sounded honestly interested. Probably he actually was, Bree thought. But Mrs. Cunningham was plainly growing impatient with this amiability and meant to nip the conversation in the bud before Roger could seduce the captain into blasphemy. Or worse.
The fact remains, Captain, that this gentleman's good mother is widely kent to be a witch, and likely his wife is one as well. Send them on their way. We've nae interest in their pretensions.
Roger swung round to face her and drew himself up to his full height, which meant his head nearly brushed the roof tree.
Mrs. Cunningham, he said,
still polite, but letting a bit of steel show through.
I beg you'll consider that I am a minister of God. My wife's beliefs and her parents' are as virtuous and moral as those of any good Christian, and I'll swear to as much. With my hand on your own Bible, if you like.
He nodded at the tiny shelf over the desk, where a Bible took pride of place in a row of smaller books.
Mm-hmm, said the captain, with a narrow-eyed glance at his mother. I'm just away to call my two lads down from the field, sir, lieutenants from my last ship, who chose to come with me when I came ashore. I'll walk you and your lady to the head of the path, if you'll bear me company that far.
Thank you, Captain.
Bree seized the chance of getting a word in sideways, and curtsied deeply to the captain, and again, with as much face as she could manage, to Mrs. Cunningham.
Do please remember that my mother will come at once, ma'am, if you have any sort of emergency.
Mrs. Cunningham seemed to expand in several directions at once.
Do you dare threaten me, girl? What? No. Do you see what you've let in the house, Captain?
Mrs. Cunningham ignored Brianna and glowered at her son.
The lass means to ill wish us.
We have a few more calls to make,
Roger interjected hastily.
Will you allow me to bless your house with a wee prayer before we leave, sir? Why?
The captain glanced at his mother, then drew himself up, chin set.
Yes, sir. We should be most obliged to you.
Brianna saw Mrs. Cunningham's lips shaped to say pfft again, but Roger hastily forestalled her, raising his hands slightly and bowing his head in benediction.
May God bless the dwelling, each stone and beam and stave, all food and drink and clothing. May health of men be always here. Good day to you, sir, madam,
he added quickly,
and, bowing, grabbed Brianna's hand. She hadn't time to say anything.
Just as well, she thought,
but smiled and nodded to the basilisk as they backed out of the door. So now we know what blue light means, she said, casting a ginger glance behind her as they reached the end of the path.
As Mama says, Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ.
Apt, Roger said, laughing. Was that a Hogman A prayer? She asked. Sounded kind of familiar, but I wasn't sure.
It is, and a house blessing. You've heard your dad say it a few times, but he does it in the Gaelic. The Cunninghams are educated lowlanders from their accent. If I'd tried the Gaelic version, Mrs. C. might well have thought I was trying to put a spell on them.
Weren't you? She said it lightly, but he turned his head to her, surprised.
Well, in a way, I suppose so,
he said slowly, but then smiled.
Highland charms and prayers often aren't distinguishable from each other. But I think if you address God directly, then it's probably a prayer rather than witchcraft.
She glanced over her shoulder once more with the feeling that Mrs. Cunningham's eyes were burning a hole through the door of the cabin watching their retreat.
Do Presbyterians believe in exorcism? She asked.
No, we don't, he said,
though he also looked back.
My father, the Reverend, I mean, did tell me, though, that when you go visiting, you should never leave a house without offering a blessing of some kind.
He held back a springy oak branch so that she could duck beneath it.
He did add that it might keep things from following you home. But I think he was joking.
I was working my way down the creek bank, collecting leeches, watercress, and anything else that looked either edible or useful, when I heard a distant sound of wagon wheels. Thinking that this might be the tinker Joe Beardsley had mentioned to Germain, I hastily shook down my skirts, shoved my feet back into my sandals, and hurried toward the wagon trace, where the rumbling of wheels had been suddenly replaced by a good deal of bad language. This proved to be coming from a very large man, who was excoriating his mules, the wagon, and the wheel that had just hit a rock and sprung its iron tire. He lacked Jamie's creativity in cursing, but was making up for it in volume. "May I help you, sir?" I asked, seizing a moment when he'd paused for breath. He swung round, astonished.
"Where the devil did you come from?"
he asked. I gestured toward the trees behind me and repeated, "Do you need help?" Closer to the wagon, it was apparent that he wasn't the tinker. The wagon, drawn by two very large mules, held a variety of things, but not iron pans and hair ribbons. There were half a dozen muskets lying in the wagon bed, together with a small collection of swords, scythes, and staves. A few small barrels that might be salt fish or pork, and one that was most certainly gunpowder, both from its markings and from the faint scent of charcoal tinged with sulphur and urine. My insides contracted.
"Is this Fraser's Ridge?"
the man demanded, looking at the woods around us. We were some way below the clearing where the Higginses' cabin stood, and there was no sign of habitation other than the wagon trace, which was quite overgrown.
"It is," I said, there being no point in lying. "Do you have business here?"
He looked sharply at me and focused on me for the first time.
"My business is my own," he said,
though not impolitely.
"I'm looking for Jamie Fraser."
"I'm Mrs. Fraser," I said, folding my arms. "His business is mine." His face flushed and he glowered at me as though thinking I was practicing upon him. But I gave him stare for stare, and after a moment he gave a sort of barking laugh and relaxed.
"Will you fetch your husband then, or will I come and find him?"
"Whom shall I say is calling?" I asked, not moving.
"Benjamin Cleveland," he said, swelling a bit with a sense of his own importance. "You'll know the name."
Jamie laid the last brick in the course and trimmed the mortar with a small feeling of satisfaction, mingled with a mild dismay at the realization that tomorrow's work on the chimney would need to be done with a ladder. This was as high as he could reach without. His shoulders were complaining. The thought of his knees joining in made him stretch his back and sigh.
Aye, well, maybe my bonny lass can help with that.
Brianna had said something to him the first night they'd come. She'd followed him through the building site, the two of them stumbling over rocks and strings and laughing as though they were drunk, bumping shoulders and grasping elbows to keep their balance in the dark. Each fleeting touch a spark that warned him. I can make a movable frame with a pulley.
That's what she'd said, putting a hand on the half-built chimney. We can hoist up a bucket of bricks you can reach from the ladder.
Oui, he said softly, smiling to himself. Then looked over his shoulder, self-conscious lest the men carrying logs should have heard him. But they'd laid down the last one and paused for refreshment. Amy Higgins and Fanny had brought beer, and he dropped the trowel in a bucket of water and went to join them. Just before he reached the edge of the foundation, though, his eye caught a flicker of movement at the head of the wagon road, and the next instant Claire came into sight, dwarfed by the man who walked beside her.
Blessed Michael defend us,
Jamie muttered under his breath. He didn't know the man, but there was something about him beyond his size that made the hairs rise on Jamie's neck. He glanced at his helpers for the day. 7 men. Bobby Higgins, 3 of his Ardsmuir men, the others tenants he didn't yet know well, and Fanny, who'd brought them lunch. None of the men had noticed the man making his way across the clearing, but Fanny had. She frowned and then looked quickly toward Jamie. He nodded to her, reassuring, and her face relaxed, though she kept glancing back down the hill even as she answered something one of the men said to her. Jamie stepped over the foundation. He had a feeling that he'd have liked to meet the fellow whilst standing in his own house with men at his back, but he had a stronger feeling that he wanted to get between the man and Claire. She was smiling politely at the man as he talked, but he could see the wariness plain in her face. She looked up, though, and saw him coming. Relief bloomed in her, and he felt an answering thrum in his chest. He walked toward them, not smiling, but looking pleasant at least.
General Fraser, said the man, looking him up and down with interest.
Aye, well, that explained Claire's wariness.
Not any more, he said,
still pleasant, and put out a hand.
Jamie Fraser, your servant, sir. Yours, sir, Benjamin Cleveland.
A sweaty hand, substantially bigger than his own, grasped him and squeezed in a manner indicating that the owner thought he could have hurt him had he wanted to. Jamie let go without response and smiled.
Aye, try it, you wee bastard. I ken your name, sir. I've heard you spoken of now and then.
From the corner of his eye he saw Claire's brows rise.
Mr. Cleveland is a famous Indian fighter, Anian, he said, not taking his eyes off the man. He's killed a good many Cree and Cherokee by his own report. Kanawage, too. I don't keep a count,
Cleveland said, chuckling in a way that said he remembered every man he'd killed and enjoyed his memories.
I suppose your relations with the Indians are a mite more amiable. I have friends in the Cherokee villages.
Not all of his friends in the villages were Indians, but Scotchy Cameron was no business of Cleveland's.
Splendid!
Cleveland's ruddy face grew redder.
I hope that might be the case.
Jamie tilted his head with a non-committal noise in his throat.